TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Missiles to Ukraine for World War III, in the nuclear age, The Gray Zone, Colonel Larry Wilkerson, and the New York Times on What Will Set Off a Nuclear War. Print and internet media in mid-September 2024 were filled with speculation whether the U.S. would agree with the U.K. to allow Ukraine to use long-range missiles to strike deep inside Russia. Here's the Miami Herald from September 16, 2024.
The U.S. and its allies could soon authorize Ukraine to launch missiles deep inside Russian territory, a move which experts say would constitute an escalation of the war. President Joe Biden is considering a Ukrainian request to fire Army tactical missile systems, ATACMS, long-range, American-made weapons, across the Russian border, according to the New York Times. The surface-to-surface missiles, which were provided to Ukraine last year, have thus far been limited to targets inside Ukraine. The UK and France are also weighing whether to permit Ukraine to use European-made missiles, including Storm Shadows and Scalps, to attack farther into Russia. The Western deliberations come after Iran began providing FAT-360 missiles, short-range ballistic weapons, to Russia. The US condemned Iran's actions as a significant and dangerous escalation. Global security experts said that by greenlighting deeper missile strikes on Russia, the US and its NATO allies would be contributing to this escalation, which carries profound risks. While we cannot forget that it's Russia who launched this war by invading Ukraine, in this case it is actually NATO that is escalating to a new level of confrontation, Robert David English, a professor of international relations, who researches Russia, at the University of Southern California, told McClatchy News. The Iran-supplied missiles have a maximum range of 75 miles, while missiles supplied by NATO can reach targets close to 200 miles away, meaning it's not a tit-for-tat retaliation, English said. We are in dangerous, uncharted territory, English said. Never before have opposing nuclear powers traveled so far up what strategists like Thomas Schelling and Herman Kahn call the ladder of escalation. Echoing this sentiment, Steve Fetter, a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, told McClatchy News, I do think there is a real chance of escalation. Russian President Vladimir Putin recently said as much himself. By allowing Ukraine to launch long-range missiles into Russia, NATO would substantially change the very essence, the nature of the conflict, putting it at war with Russia, Putin said in early September, according to the BBC. Asked to respond to these comments on September 14, Biden said, I don't think much about Vladimir Putin. While authorizing further strikes on Russia would be risky, there also exist risks in not acting, James Goldgeier, a professor of foreign policy and global security at American University, said. If the US and its allies do not permit these strikes, it would leave Ukraine vulnerable to these devastating attacks and will make it harder for it to survive, Goldgeier said. Iran's supply of missiles to Russia makes this more important. It should be said that such long-range strikes will not win the war for Ukraine, Sergei Rudchenko, a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, told McClatchy News. What they might do is deter Russia from carrying out strikes of its own, leading to a kind of balance of deterrence, which could actually aid in bringing the war to an end. Russia has relocated many of its military systems out of range of ATACMS, potentially blunting their impact, according to the New York Times. Neither the White House nor the Kremlin responded to requests for comment from McClatchy News.
That was a piece from the National Pages of the Miami Herald from 9/16/24 under the title, U.S. May Let Ukraine Fire Missiles Deep Inside Russia. Here's why experts say it's risky. The leading argument by politicians for an incursion into Russia is the often repeated statement that Putin plans to take over all of Ukraine and move on from there. A secret guarded for over 2 years now is the fact that the first meeting to end the war was held 4 days after the start of the war between Ukrainian and Russian negotiators in Belarus. A second and third round of talks took place on March 3rd and 7th, and a fourth and fifth round were held on March 10 and 14 in Turkey. However, U.S. State Department staff under Victoria Nuland and the U.K. government under Boris Johnson intervened and pressured Zelensky not to accept the deal. By strange coincidence, right in the middle of this current September 2024 period of possible escalation to nuclear war, the Gray Zone announced on September 15, 24 that, quote, former U.S. State Department official Victoria Nuland acknowledges openly that the U.S. and U.K. sabotaged peace talks between Russia and Ukraine in April 2022. The Gray Zone's Max Blumenthal and Aaron Maté cover her stunning admission. Here's Max Blumenthal.
Aaron, there could have been a peace deal. There were certainly peace discussions. You've been talking about this for months and months and months. And now you have confirmation from none other than Victoria Nuland.
Relatively late in the game, the Ukrainians began asking for advice on where this thing was going. And it became clear to us, clear to the Brits, clear to others, that Putin's main condition was buried in an annex to this document that they were working on. Mm-hmm. And it included limits on the precise kinds of weapon systems that Ukraine could have after the deal, such that Ukraine would basically be neutered as a military force. And there were no similar constraints on Russia. Russia wasn't required to pull back. Russia wasn't required to have a buffer zone from the Ukrainian border, wasn't required to have the same constraints on its military facing Ukraine. And so people inside Ukraine and people outside Ukraine started asking questions about whether this was a good deal. And it was at that point that it fell apart.
This is an extraordinary statement for many reasons. First of all, this is not news to people who watch the Gray Zone. We've been talking about this from the start. And of course, we've been attacked for saying that the U.S. stood in the way of a peace deal. People like progressive proxy warriors, like former Bernie Sanders advisor Matt Duss, has called us out for saying that the U.S. stood in the way of a peace deal and mocked the idea that the U.S. did. We've had so many officials admit this now. The top Ukrainian negotiator said that all Russia wanted was basically Ukrainian neutrality. That was their main demand. Another Ukrainian negotiator said that Russia made a very real compromise. He said Putin did everything possible to make peace. The admissions of all these people does nothing to put a dent in the propaganda narrative, because the claim that there was a peace deal undermines the narrative needed to sustain the proxy war. So it just, all this gets buried. So this is just more evidence for those who didn't need it, because we all know that this was the truth. But anyway, what I think is really significant here is I do think for the first time we've gotten a high-level official to admit the actual reason why the deal didn't go through. Now we get Nuland saying a brand new thing. She said it's because Russia wanted limits on what weapon systems could be placed in Ukraine.
No!
Yes. So you mean that Russia, after seeing Ukraine go through a coup in which the U.S. helped overthrow a government calling for neutrality, and seeing that that coup government had a war on the Donbas because they didn't want to respect the autonomous rights of ethnic Russian Ukrainians, that after all this, Russia didn't want to have Ukraine basically hosting advanced U.S. weapon systems right on its borders. So that's basically Nuland admitting that the U.S. blocked this treaty or opposed it because they want to preserve the right of Ukraine to basically be used to threaten Russia with U.S. weapon systems. So I think actually we're getting refreshingly, for the first time, a candid admission as to why the U.S. blocked this deal.
Sergei Lavrov, foreign minister of Russia, recently said that this isn't about territory. It's not about us and our desire to have territory. It's about the abrogation of the rights of some 35% of Ukrainians who speak Russia, who had their rights completely erased after the Maidan coup, which is correct. And you can see like what's been happening there. Russian language stripped as an official language, not taught in schools anymore, the worship of Bandera, the jailing of Russian-speaking critics of the government, the disappearance of hundreds of human rights activists from the Donbass, just killings of people across the Donbass. All of that is not respected as a grievance by Victoria Nuland or anyone in Washington. I don't even think there's an understanding of it. And so a war is taking place to bring things back to that point, and it never will. And all we hear are calls for escalation.
And it looks like Ukraine actually will likely get its latest request from the Biden administration, which is for long-range missile strikes with U.S. weapons into Russia. So this is the latest step in the escalation ladder. So if we're going by established patterns so far, I think this is Blinken signaling that, yes, this permission will be granted to Ukraine for long-range strikes. And there's a quote circulating from Mike McCaul, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, saying that Blinken told him that he's going to give this authorization. So, I mean, we'll see. I mean, like, you never know. But if we're going by established pattern, I think there's a lot of reasons to think that actually, yes, Biden is going to authorize, or whoever is making the decision is going to authorize this stuff. It's just unbelievable, especially in light of Nuland's admission that all this could have been avoided had the U.S. and U.K. just let its client in Kyiv reach a peace deal that it negotiated itself with Russia, which was a pretty simple one. It was for Ukraine to declare neutrality, which is not a radical demand. It was enshrined in Ukraine's founding constitution. In exchange, Russia would withdraw to the pre-invasion lines. The status of Crimea and Donbas would be worked out directly between Putin and Zelensky. And especially given that you have many elements of the ultranationalist movement inside Ukraine who don't even want the Donbas because it has all these ethnic Russians who want to speak Russian and want closer ties with Russia. I mean, the fact that the U.S. basically ordered Zelensky to continue this war and sacrifice his country, how many hundreds of thousands of people have died just so Victoria Nuland can sit there with a smirk on her face now and say what a wonderful thing it is that we blocked this deal because it would have prevented Ukraine from hosting advanced U.S. weapon systems inside its territory. It's unbelievable.
That was The Gray Zone of September 15, 2024, with Aaron Mate and Max Blumenthal. On that same day, I found a letter from Code Pink in my email. They wrote, "Dear Mariah, the Biden administration has lost its mind as it inches us closer to nuclear war with Russia. The United States and United Kingdom are ready to announce that they will be lifting restrictions on Ukraine's use of NATO weapons, allowing them to be used to strike deep inside Russia," according to The Guardian and Politico. "President Biden, Vice President Harris, and the whole national security team would rather jeopardize life on this planet than negotiate an end to the U.S. proxy war between Ukraine and Russia. Think of the tens of thousands of lives that could have been saved if the U.S. had not torpedoed the peace agreement," end quote. That was a letter from Code Pink, emailed to me on September 14, 2024. A week earlier, September 7, 2024, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff of Secretary of State Colin Powell, spoke at a conference of the Washington, D.C.-based Schiller Institute. Lawrence Wilkerson.
"I was rereading Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar a week ago, and I came to those lines in Act 3, Scene 1, I believe, where a man who is setting his own destiny, committing suicide, essentially, Mark Antony, makes those famous words, whether he said it or not, is moot. Shakespeare said he said it. Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war." That's a perfect way to describe, we have decided in the American Empire to cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. The dogs of war happen to be very sophisticated these days and will destroy us all. And I'd like to take you back to 2002, when the first national security strategy came out that I think is still very relevant, because it was written by a lot of the people who are behind this and their descendants, if you will, who are still very much with us. And that security strategy, summed up in its essence, said the United States, the American Empire, will not tolerate any opposition in the world to its primacy at all. And when Secretary Powell and I talked about it, he was somewhat disturbed by some of the wording, but he wasn't as disturbed as I thought he should be. And when it boiled down to where I really wanted to impress upon him how disturbed I was, I said, do you realize that that means that anyone, we're on the top of the mountain, boss. We're at the peak of the mountain. Cold War put us there because we won it. We're at the peak of the mountain. And if we see anyone stirring at the bottom of that mountain, a mouse, a rat, a beaver, anyone stirring at the bottom of that mountain, it doesn't matter what their intentions and capabilities are. Those are the two things you want to look at when you're assessing any enemy or potential enemy, is what are his capabilities and what are his intentions. And the latter sometimes is more important than the former. But this strategy said, if it stirs, we will kill it. Well, the first thing I said to the secretary was that means we are going to concentrate almost entirely on the military instrument. We are going to become, if we aren't already, a national security state. And if you want to know what a national security state is in microcosm, look at Israel right now. It is a national security state. And as long as it remains a Jewish state, it will be a national security state into the future until it is destroyed. What does that mean? That means that your entire intellectual capacity, your entire industry, your entire thought process is constantly aimed at, if not 24/7, close to that, the enemy, the people who might do you harm. And that's the reason I say Israel won't be a state much longer, not if it remains a Jewish state, because it will always have an enemy and Jews will not be very secure there, and therefore they will leave. Well, imagine the United States of America, probably in many respects, of the thousands of empires over the last two millennia or longer, the one with the most incredible capacity to do damage to the world. Imagine if it becomes a national security state. Oh, don't imagine it. We already are. We are a national security state. Our raison d'etre is our security. And that 2002 national security strategy said that in no uncertain terms. And we've been manufacturing the capabilities to go along with that strategy ever since. One of the reasons it frightens me as a soldier that this is happening is because I know the incredible deterioration of what I would call our conventional warfighting capabilities. And that means those things that you use to fight a war other than nuclear weapons. We're in dire straits right now, in many respects, in the conventional military. We're in dire straits partly because we have decided that we don't need it, and that decision has not been published for the American people to look at, except for proxy wars and brushfire wars. We don't need it in the defense of the United States because, bingo, we have nuclear weapons. Not only do we have nuclear weapons, but we are building out that complex associated with them at great profit to the niche military industrial complex that is associated with it. We're building it out to make sure that we can survive. And we hope that the old mantra of deterrence still works and that we will cow everyone in the world who is equipped with nuclear weapons, now 9 states, so much so that we won't actually have to use them. My fear is that they are going to have to be used because we are going to, regardless of our disdain for conventional warfare and the instruments thereof, regardless of that disdain, we're going to get sucked into something that is initially conventional. And I can describe you scenarios in Taiwan and the South China Sea, scenarios elsewhere with China, and other scenarios that might be conducive to just that thing. Look at Ukraine, look at Israel today. I could see them going regional very rapidly, and at first without nuclear weapons use. But eventually, the dynamics of such a conflict, matched with that national security strategy that I just described to you, and the ethic and the thought process that accompanies it, will lead to nuclear weapons. And once again, the American Empire, as it was in 1945, will be the country to use nuclear weapons first. Because in that conventional struggle, which as in Ukraine and Israel might start out as a proxy struggle, in that struggle, once we start losing, which we most assuredly will, and bingo, footnote this, if we do what Bibi Netanyahu wants us to do and take on Iran in a serious way, that could be the very struggle I'm talking about that eventually will lead to nuclear use. And we will be the ones to use it first. I think that's one of the reasons lying behind the idea that Dr. Postol just briefly suggested to us in this trying to build this invulnerability into what we want to do with our nuclear weapons. It's not just for deterrence, it's also for warfighting. And to magnify and emphasize that, I am hearing for the first time since I read about it in the early 50s and all the way up to 62, 63, 64, I'm hearing military officers, high-ranking military officers, talk again about nuclear weapons in a fashion that they did at that time, that they do have utility, that they can be used. And then footnote that and think about missiles like the Russians have now, which they are now showing in Ukraine in brief episodes that go, yes, they go 32,000 kilometers per hour. If you do the math, that's about 19,000 miles per hour. These are incredibly fast missiles. They cannot be shot down. There is no ballistic missile defense for these missiles. The one that just hit the facility in Ukraine that caused a big hoorah because it was a training facility is about a 4,500 mile an hour missile. These are incredible developments on that side of the field, as well as those that were expounded earlier on our side of the field. This is a very dangerous time. And as you've heard me say before, and I will say it again here, we, the American Empire, no one else in the world, abrogated every single nuclear weapons regime treaty that we had so carefully crafted during the Cold War, to include the most successful one of all, one that eliminated an entire class of nuclear weapons, the most dangerous, in my view, the INF Treaty. We took them all out. And something we don't realize, too, is we took out the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. Now, why would I say that in connection with nuclear weapons? Because CFE was very important in connection with the INF Treaty and other nuclear weapons treaties. The distance now between conventional weaponry that is so accurate, it has nuclear ground effects, if you will, on the battlefield, and nuclear weapons themselves, in actuality, is very thin. When we were watching the Russians in 2013 and 2014, fundamentally through the eyes of the Swiss and the Finns and the Norwegians who were observing their exercises, army size, corps size exercises, we found the reason they were building a doctrine that later became called escalate to de-escalate was because they feared NATO's possession of precision-guided munitions, because they thought the advantage NATO had in PGMs was so great that it had the impact of a nuclear weapon. By the way, we were saying that too. We were saying at one point that we didn't need tactical nuclear weapons anymore because PGMs would do the same thing when carefully concentrated. So their doctrine became, if NATO attacks the CSTO, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, then we will blunt that attack with a nuclear weapon, a small yield nuclear weapon, or two or three. And that's escalate to de-escalate, because they felt their disadvantage against NATO's PGMs was so significant that that's what they had to do. Now, that's evolved now, and Sergei Lavrov and Vladimir Putin have talked about this evolution. And incidentally, Putin was very, very dramatic when he said, our triad is better than your triad, trying to insinuate that if it were a nuclear war, it wouldn't be confined to Europe and it would be significantly detrimental to us as well as the rest of the world. All of this is going on now within the context of normality, of just this is the thing to do. This is what's necessary. And it's all fueled by, as I said before, the military-industrial scientific think tank, complex out there that makes lots of money. And incidentally, the nuclear weapons complex is a very niche-like complex that makes tons of money for very few people. So that's a motivator for this, too. They don't want this complex to die. I saw their fear. Believe me, I saw their fear in 1991 and 92 when we were destroying Russian warheads so fast it'd make your head spin, and our own too, and going from some 30,000 warheads on both sides down to somewhere around 5,000 today, and with a full intent to go down to 1,200 on both sides. So it scared the bejesus out of the nuclear weapons complex, both those senators in Congress who protected it and those people at the labs and elsewhere who performed in it. So we have a huge problem in the American empire because we are letting slip the dogs of war, and the dogs of war are nuclear weapons. And there's nothing anymore to control those weapons other than the insane leaders of that empire. Thank you.
That was Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff of Secretary of State Colin Powell. He spoke on September 7, 2024. All the speeches, letters, and events in this program come in the context of a New York Times article from August 20, 2024. They broke the story that the Biden administration last March had quietly approved a new, quote, nuclear employment guidance, involving preparing to fight and win a three-front nuclear war against Russia, China, and North Korea. Also quoted was the September 2nd report in London's Financial Times that the U.S. Biden administration and the U.K. are about to revise their existing Mutual Defense Agreement, MDA. It joins the two countries' nuclear weapons programs at the hip to extend it indefinitely without requiring renewal. In other words, de facto make the MDA a U.S. treaty without the inconvenience of having to get it approved by the Senate, as the Constitution requires. You heard a program produced in mid-September 2024 while the world watched with trepidation whether Ukraine would be given permission to shoot NATO-supplied long-range missiles into Russia. It raises the question, what will set off a nuclear war? The speakers were Aaron Maté and Max Blumenthal from the Gray Zone, Colonel Larry Wilkerson, and quotes from print media such as the Miami Herald and the New York Times. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelardin. Thank you for listening.